Kia ora tātou. This evening we're going to carry on with our anniversaries and commemorations, and this time it's the 110th anniversary of the Gallipoli landings. And it's great to be able to welcome back a regular speaker that we have, Dr. Ian McGibbon, who I guess is New Zealand's resident expert on Gallipoli, and he'll explain why. So without further mucking around, could you please welcome Ian for his presentation?
Thank you, Joe. It's a pleasure to be back in Palmerston North. I think this is the third speech that I've given to your group, especially for the 110th anniversary of the Gallipoli landings. Those decade anniversaries are quite important. I was very privileged and lucky to be at the 90th and the 100th at Gallipoli itself. The 205 ceremony was quite amazing because there were 20,000 people present at the Anzac commemorative site. And I still have vivid memories of the 700 buses gradually, slowly grinding past that site. Of course, they realised that they couldn't go on because the 100th was coming up and they might have 40,000 people there. So they started wondering about fixing the roads. And as soon as they started fixing the roads, Australians got up in arms about bones being exposed. And the upshot of that was that I ended up going to Gallipoli six years in a row for a month to walk around the battlefield as part of a Turkish-Australian-New Zealand survey of the battlefield. I have to say it was the most enjoyable work that I ever did during my career. The 2015 event was much smaller, only about 10,000 people present. The government balloted for that, and I think New Zealand had 2,500 people present. A much smaller, more sedate affair. This year, I'm sure the crowd will be probably under 1,000, which is probably inevitable given that we're now past the centenary. When Joe asked me to speak, I wondered, what am I going to speak about? Because we could talk about the campaign itself. I did that. I spoke about Colonel Malone's fictitious or mythical refusing an order on Chinook beer the last time I spoke, and I thought, given that this is 2025, rather than speaking about the campaign itself, let's talk more about what New Zealanders did in the 6 years after the war finished, building up to the unveiling of the New Zealand Memorial, which took place on the 12th of May, exactly 100 years ago, next month. So I'm going to focus on the centenary of the completion of the Imperial War Graves Commission's work at Gallipoli and the unveiling of the New Zealand Memorial at Chinook Beer in 2025. Now, the Imperial War Graves Commission worked in three areas on the Gallipoli Peninsula. One was at Hallis, where the British and French and the New Zealanders briefly and Australians briefly fought the main campaign during the Gallipoli battles. The Suvla area was basically where the British landed in August in an attempt to create a new front. And of course, Anzac is where the Australians and New Zealanders landed on the 25th of April 1915 and fought there until the end of the campaign in December. The area expanded in August, but the old part of Anzac is what I'm going to focus on in this talk. I'm going to look at how the Anzac area, as it was known, was formed and the work that was done within it by New Zealanders. And that's the Anzac area, which is a specific area. It's embodied in the Treaty of Lausanne of 1923. I have to say that in more recent times, its significance is greatly reduced. The Turkish government tends to sort of overrule everything now in that area. Not complaining, because the Turkish government has done a wonderful job in preserving the whole Gallipoli battlefield, or the Anzac part of it, as a peace park. If you went to Gallipoli, this is a 2004 picture that I took. At the entrance of the Anzac area, there were those marker stones, the white marker at the bottom, and a sign that said, "You are now entering the area which is reserved forever as a last resting place for soldiers who fell in the First World War. In this area, it is forbidden to camp, light fires, or pick flowers." In fact, there were a whole lot of other prohibitions, which I'll talk about later. Those signs now are sort of overshadowed by the Turkish Peace Park signs. And the area remains a legal entity, but I don't think New Zealand or Australia could ever take any action about the area in these times, 100 years later. So I'm going to talk about New Zealand's part in forming that area. Firstly, the political activity, then the diplomatic action that was needed to create it, and then I'll focus on what was done within that area in the period leading up to 2025. So the first person to really come to light in this speech is Prime Minister William Massey. On Anzac Day 1916, the first anniversary, he said, "I want to say this, and I'm expressing my own opinion, and I'm sure also that of many others. We shall be humiliated if the feet of strangers are allowed to leave their prints on the graves of our heroic boys. Such a thing would be nothing short of desecration." Now, you've got to remember, we evacuated the peninsula, we left everything as it was, and surprisingly, much of it's still there, the trenches and things. The bodies of those who fell, many were buried by there during the campaign, of course, but there were many, many bodies between the lines that just were left lying in where they fell until 2018. So by that time they were mostly bones, but during that time, 1915 till 1918, there were quite a lot of people in New Zealand and elsewhere talking about trying to make that area into a park, and they were going to plant it with Australian and New Zealand plants. And quite a bit of work was done in Egypt at the gardens there in Cairo, trying to grow New Zealand and Australian plants. Unfortunately, none of them really worked in that climate, in that position. So on the 9th of May, which is just a few days after his Anzac speech, Massey spoke in Parliament again. The government had put this as part of their programme. "My ministers hope that when the terms of peace are considered, it may be possible to reserve for New Zealand and Australia the ground where our men fought and so many fell in the service of the Empire. Whether the arrangement be made by treaty, by purchase, or by conquest, I hope and I believe that Gallipoli, at all events, the part of it in which we are particularly concerned, will pass into the possession of the British people, and in particular, under the control of the people that we are in the habit of referring to as Anzacs. Gallipoli would," he declared, "be sacred soil to the end of time." Now, nothing really happened after that, until 1917, when Massey or the Dominion leaders were called into discussions with the British government. Big development in the development of New Zealand's independence, eventual event, independence. The Imperial War Conference of 1917, and Massey went there determined to get some resolution on what was going to happen after the war ended. Of course, in 1917, no one knew when the war would end. It seemed like an interminable conflict. But he managed to get the conference to agree, and I have to say the Australians were nowhere near as interested in this at this time. Until the war ended, they really didn't take much action or interest in what Massey was pushing forward. So the conference did agree that this conference was strongly of the opinion that when peace terms are being arranged, an earnest endeavour shall be made to place that part of the Gallipoli Peninsula where lie the remains of so many British and overseas Dominion soldiers under the control of an imperial organisation upon which Australia, New Zealand and India should be represented for the purposes of ensuring that the bodies of the heroes who gave their lives for the Empire at the most critical time in all its history shall be cared for in a manner worthy of the deeds they performed and the sacrifices they made. So the resolution went into the books and everyone dispersed, and the war continued until 1918 when the Germans finally were defeated. And everything changed. I did mention that Australia didn't take vigorous action before the end of the war, but shortly after the war ended, Charles Bean, who had been the journalist at Gallipoli, Australian war correspondent at Gallipoli, and later became the historian of the official historian of the Australian effort at Gallipoli, he took a mission to Gallipoli, a number of people, and they surveyed the battlefield, took photographs, and came back. And from that time, the Australian government did become very proactive about creating a special area at Anzac. The Prime Minister, Billy Hughes, urged David Lloyd George the need to vest the whole Anzac area in the Imperial Graves Commission. This was a new development. The commission had been created just at the end of the war, so they did have an organisation now that could take action in this area. So the focus then shifted to the Paris Peace Conference in 1919. Massey was quite active at the conference, mainly trying to get control of Samoa, but he also was focused on the Graves at Gallipoli. He put forward a proposal that a clause should be inserted in the peace treaty ceding to Great Britain some hundreds of acres of land containing the graves of Anzac troops who fell during the war, the ground to be preserved and consecrated as a memorial to them. This got some traction with the British Empire delegation, which the Dominions, including New Zealand, were part of. The delegation asked the Imperial General Staff in London's geographical section to provide a description of the land that might be desired to acquire with a view to the preservation as its preservation as British territory by treaty. So that was a major step. They're now actually working on what the area that was going to be preserved would be. And in the Treaty of Sèvres, not the Treaty of Versailles, the Treaty of Sèvres with the Ottoman Empire in 1920, it was included the map I showed you, map 3, that's from the Treaty of Sèvres initially. The problem with the Treaty of Sèvres is that only one country ratified it, which was Greece. Greece was going to be awarded the Dodonovan Peninsula under that treaty. The problem was that the Ottoman Empire was on its last legs. Mustafa Kemal, who had fought the Anzacs at Gallipoli, although he wasn't the main commander, he performed with great distinction there, but he had led a rebellion against the Ottoman Empire, and basically power shifted to him in Ankara rather than the Sultan in Constantinople. So everything changed, and the Sevres Treaty was basically became redundant because Mustafa Kemal's government was never going to accept those terms, and they had enough power in the centre of Anatolia and Turkey to resist, which they did, and they eventually threw the Greeks out of that area. In 1922, the Greeks collapsed and were driven back. Kemal's forces came down almost to Gallipoli, which was actually occupied by French and British battalions under the occupation terms of the armistice. It looked like war was going to happen with Turkey again, or with Kemal's Turkish forces. New Zealand agreed that they would send forces immediately, which was quite a stirring thing, and 12,000 people volunteered to go, which is surprising because after a war in which so many people had died, you would think there'd be resistance, but no, 12,000 volunteered within five days to go back and have another battle with the Turks. That led to an agreement that there'd have to be another peace settlement, and that was going to take place in Lausanne, and that's where the battle for the Anzac area eventually took place. New Zealand wasn't represented at Lausanne, nor was Australia. The British did the negotiations, and Lord Curzon was the Foreign Secretary at the time, and he had quite a surprisingly strong battle with Mustafa Kemal's foreign minister over whether they should reserve this area. And Curzon said at one point in the debate, "These people, inspired by the highest patriotism, came from the ends of the earth to fight in the noblest of causes. Cannot we allow these dead to repose in circumstances of dignity and peace? The piece of land involved is a little bit of rough ground, about 4.5 kilometres long and only 1.5 kilometres broad. In this area, there are 19 actual cemeteries, and over all the ground between, which is a network of trenches, half covered in or not covered in, lie the unidentified remains of many other soldiers. The ground is uninhabited and uncultivated. It is of no value to the Turkish government or to any human being. But to Australians and New Zealanders, it is of the deepest historical and sentimental significance." So anyone who's been to Gallipoli will agree with that. The land is very rugged. There's no agricultural possibilities in the area that the Anzacs fought. Suffice to say that Curzon's arguments prevailed in the end, and the treaty eventually included the map and an Article 129. I didn't put all of it up here, there's lots of other conditions, but it stated that the land to be granted by Turkey would include, in particular, as regards the British Empire, the area in the region known as Anzac Aribanu, which is shown on map number 3. Conditions included that the area shall not be applied to any other purpose than that laid down in the present treaty. Consequently, it shall not be utilised for any military or commercial object. The Turkish government was to have the right to inspect the area, but essentially it was going to be under the control of the Imperial War Graves Commission, and no dwellings, houses, were to be erected in the area. And that has prevailed. There are no houses built for ordinary citizens is a house built for the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. But otherwise, the area has been respected. That's the map again of the area that was included in the Treaty of Lausanne. So that was basically the achievement of the Anzac area that Massey had foreshadowed. From that point, I'm going to go now back to 1918 and talk about what was done about the people lying on the battlefield. So when the Ottoman Empire finally accepted an armistice on the 30th of October 1918, the British didn't waste much time in sending forces to the Gallipoli Peninsula, mainly because of the importance of the Dardanelles, of course, but they also sent a Graves Registration Unit to try and locate all the bodies that were still lying in the battlefield and locate the cemetery, the graves that people had, soldiers had already dug for their mates and put them into makeshift graves all over the battlefield. They also sent the Canterbury Mounted Rifles Regiment, as well as the 7th Light Horse Australian Unit. They went straight to the peninsula, and they were the ones that scoured the battlefield. They were gone by January 1919, though, and that left the Graves Registration Unit to keep working until October 1919. And they established 26 cemeteries at Gallipoli. 19 of them were in the Anzac area. And there was one New Zealander in the Graves Registration Unit, Vernon Bigwither. Oh, this is the sort of work that the Graves Registration Unit was doing. These are the bones that were on Chunuk Bear. But remember, 600 New Zealand soldiers lost their lives in that attack on the high point at Gallipoli, at Anzac. These were bones that were gathered up in the area below Chunuk Bear, and were put into the cemetery that they created just below the summit. The guy in the he's saluting at the top there. Now, I'm going to talk about the four New Zealanders who were basically involved in the work in the Anzac area. Captain Clifton Vernon Bigwither, mentioned in dispatches in 1918, he was a farmer in North Auckland on enlistment. He served in the Auckland Mounted Rifles, which landed at Gallipoli on the 12th of May 1915. Without their horses, of course. He was appointed regimental quartermaster in June, and eventually, or later than a year, became a commissioned officer in the field. After the evacuation in December, he went back to Egypt, of course, and that's where he was appointed quartermaster for the regiment, for the Anzac Brigade, Mounted Brigade, and he served in the divisional train of the Anzac Mounted Division from 1916 to 1918. So he was appointed to the Graves Registration Unit as soon as the war ended, and he worked with them until late 1919. For some reason, he decided to come home. I don't think he had permission, because on his personal file was letters from the GR, the unit, asking where he is and when is he back on duty. He was on a ship going back to New Zealand. But he believed that he was going back. He was going to have a brief period in New Zealand, and then he would go back to Gallipoli. That didn't happen, because the Defence Minister decided in April 1920 that no, he would stay in New Zealand. So his involvement in these activities ended, although He pops up in books as someone who was there for 3 or 4 years. Fact is, he was out of it by April, by early 1920. Now, when the Graves Registration Unit left, the Australians offered to carry out the work for the Imperial War Graves Commission at Gallipoli, and the Commission agreed on that, and Australia sent a team, 11 men, led by Lieutenant Colonel Cyril Hughes, who had actually been in the Graves Registration Unit as the Australian representative. So he had a team of 11 Australians and one New Zealander. And that New Zealander, here's the team, and you can see one lemon squeezer hat there in the back. This is a photo appeared in the Otago Witness. So Honorary Lieutenant Arthur Mildenhall was the New Zealander who was appointed to serve with the Australian team. He was born in 1884 and been a builder when he enlisted in 1915. And Joe liked this because he was a sapper officer. Sapper served with the 2nd Field Company, New Zealand Engineers at Gallipoli, from the 2nd of June to the 1st of September 1915. When, like many of the people who served, he succumbed to illness and had to be evacuated. He recovered and went on to serve on the Western Front from 1916 to 1918. And he took his discharge in the United Kingdom instead of coming back to New Zealand, and got a job with the Imperial War Graves Commission. And they appointed him to be Clerk of Works at Gallipoli. And that's how he came to be a major figure in the proceedings there. He's sent a number of letters to the paper, and I found a few comments he made. He arrived in November 1920. He said, "We found things in a pretty bad state. There was very little accommodation, and such as did exist was very bad. We managed to exist in an old Turkish fort called Kilid Bahia, and as soon as the weather was at all decent and the roads passable, we set to work and built quarters for ourselves, and also repaired such roads as had existed sometime in the past. There was also constructed a new road from here to Anzac, and then on to Suvla. All this took the best part of 2 years, after which we were able to set to work on the cemeteries, and I'm pleased to say that we have now got the end in sight." That's a comment he was recorded in September 1923. In another comment he made, somewhat about the primitive conditions, "There is now a small colony of pioneers in Gallipoli, and 5 of the married men have their own cottages, which they largely build themselves from the local stone and roof with corrugated iron." It's interesting to note that Mrs. Mildenhall was the first Englishwoman to live on the Gallipoli Peninsula. Well, unfortunately, she was a very sad case because he married her on a visit back to England in 1921. And in 1922, she went home to see her parents by train, and somewhere on the train she caught a virus and died. So she was the first woman, and also the first woman who died after being on the peninsula, which was pretty tough on Arthur Mildenhall, of course. And they had all sorts of other problems. The sandflies evidently were just horrendous, and they had lots of labour problems. Once the Greeks lost their battle with Ataturk, as he became, they all disappeared back to Greece. They were expelled, in fact. And use had to be made of Russian exiles, people who had come from Russia because of the revolution and the civil war there, or Italians So they did most of the work on creating the cemeteries. And this is a photo of the work state of the cemeteries when the Australian team got there. This is what the graves registration unit had left. Makeshift graves with wooden crosses. Nowhere near as permanent as the War Graves Commission intended to do. And in the background you can see a ship that was still a wrecked ship. The Anzac commemorative site is just here or near there. This is another photo. The caption of this one actually says New Zealand that you can see him with his lemon squeezer. Was big with him, but in fact it's not, because 1923 he was farming in North Auckland. I spent hours trying to find a photo of Big Weather, but for some reason none survive or have been found. That's a similar picture. So the photos I'm going to show you now are some of the work that was done on the cemeteries. These photos were in the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. Dr. Richard Reed, who was one of my colleagues on the survey that we did at Gallipoli, he went to London and copied all these photos from the early work done at Gallipoli. I just put a few that show Mildred Hall at work. I just wanted to acknowledge Richard Reed's part in bringing these photos to you. This is Lone Pine Cemetery. They're building the walls around the cemetery. He's obviously, as the clerk of works, he's going along checking that everything has been done to the plan, no doubt. This is Shell Green Cemetery, which is not really a New Zealand lake. There's not maybe one. There may be Australians in this cemetery, but Milburn Hall is somewhere on this photo. Actually see him. I think he's under the patio looking at his papers. That's another photo of the Shell Green Cemetery. You can see Milburn Hall with his lemon squeezer hat, dealing with probably the Australians who were supervising the labour people building the actual walls of the cemetery. This is Quinn's Post Cemetery, and there's Milburn Hall again. Interesting photo, because in the background is a sort of a flying fox or whatever it is, obviously installed to carry blocks of marble or rock.
Limestone,
up to Chinook Beer. I hadn't realised there was anything like that. That, of course, is one of the more important New Zealand cemeteries, which Malone in particular made his name in defending. It doesn't show quite how vulnerable that position was, where the cemetery is basically on top of no man's land between the Turks and the New Zealanders. I like this photo, not only for the Sphinx in the background, but this is Canterbury Cemetery, and if you see in the front there, there's all those stones. These are the actual stones that were replaced the wooden crosses. And I was surprised actually at how deep those stones had been installed. Only the top foot is basically above the ground, you can see an indentation where they would put the plaque telling you who the soldier was. But they certainly put in there to last. That, of course, is Walker's Ridge at the left. This cemetery is at Chonickbear. And those are all the bones have been buried in separate graves. I'm not sure that they've managed to separate the bones into complete skeletons, but they buried a great number. On the western front, if you go to a cemetery, it's got a headstone with known unto God, if it's an unknown soldier. But at Gallipoli, they don't. They just leave the grave completely empty of any headstone or marker. That's what the Graves Registration Unit left for the Australian team to deal with once it was in place. That Chonickbear Cemetery is not, in fact, within the area, the Anzac area, as specified in the treaty, although it does lie within the responsibilities of the War Graves Commission, like cemeteries at Suvla and Hells. Hill 60 Cemetery is not within the Anzac area, nor is 12 Tree Copse Cemetery at Hells. Those are important New Zealand cemeteries for the number of New Zealanders buried in them. But all the cemeteries outside the Anzac area were specified as under the jurisdiction of the Imperial War Graves Commission, according to the Article 129 of the Treaty of Lausanne. The Chonickbear Memorial also was encircled with markers, the same markers that encircled the Anzac area. And you can still see some of those markers still remain there today, but certainly not the circle that's long gone. So, turning now to that memorial, Edmund Maher was the third New Zealander involved in the work at Gallipoli, born in 1891. He was an architectural assistant when he enlisted in 1915. He served in the Expeditionary Force in France with the 2nd Battalion, 3rd Rifle Brigade, and between 1916 and 1918. He was a Lance Corporal when the war ended. And he also took his discharge in the UK, and he was awarded a Expeditionary Force Architectural Scholarship. Lots of people remained in Britain to get professional qualifications. That was one of the government's decisions, that they would take advantage of the fact these people were in Britain, they should upskill themselves for their rehabilitation. And he worked for Sir John Burnett, who was the principal architect for the Gallipoli Palestine cemeteries and also for most of the ones on the Western Front. And Edmund Maher went to Gallipoli and worked there on the memorials until 1925. And he supervised the construction of the New Zealand Memorial at Chonickbear. Of course, Sir John Burnett was involved in the Hallis Memorial at the end of the bottom of the peninsula, which is the Imperial Memorial. And this is a picture. I can see Sir John Burnett on the left. I surmise that is Edmund Maher, and I suspect they're at a quarry working out what rocks or blocks of rock that they can get for their memorials. Which brings me to the other New Zealander involved, Samuel Hurst Seeger, who was a Christchurch architect, and he was appointed official architect of New Zealand Battlefield Memorials. of course, there were four on the Western Front and one at Gallipoli. And it was him that designed the memorial at Chinacbeer. Interestingly, there's no Australian memorial at Gallipoli. The Australians will tell you that the memorial, the obelisk at Lone Pine, is actually the Australian memorial, but it's not. It's the Anzac memorial to both New Zealand and Australia. They've requisitioned it, but it's not an Australian memorial. The New Zealand government was very keen to have its own memorials and have them at the places where our troops, the main battlefields that our troops served in. And this is an interesting photo because this is the very early stages of building the memorial at Chinacbeer. I can see Mildon Hall there and Sir John Burnett, the second from the right. Cyril Hughes, the Australian team leader, is second from the left, and I surmise and think that's probably Hurst Seeger on the left. And they're surveying the requirements to actually build the memorial. And that's a photo taken in 1925, which shows the actual completed memorial. And it shows you the cemetery, and I mentioned about no headstones for the unknown soldiers. The only ones who are known were the 11 at the bottom. One of those, of course, is a 17-year-old boy, the youngest, I think, not the youngest to serve, but the youngest to die at Gallipoli, serving with the New Zealand forces. The youngest was 14 years old, also in the engineers. But that is the completed cemetery, preparing for the unveiling, which Cyril Hughes made this comment when he went back to London late in 1924. He told a journalist that the whole of the construction work of the cemeteries and memorials was completed in September. The work carried out included 6 cemeteries at Hallis, 4 at Suvla, 21 at Anzac, 2 at Constantinople, or Istanbul as it is today, and 2 at Mudros. There are also 3 memorials to the missing, a New Zealand one on top of Chinacbeer, an Australian one at Lone Pine, which is wrong, and the Imperial Memorial at Cape Hallis. Curious that he actually claimed that was the Australian memorial, but so the unveiling of the New Zealand memorial took place on the 12th of May, 1925, and Sir Alexander Godley came from England to unveil it. He had been the commander of the New Zealand and Australian Division at Gallipoli, and briefly the Corps, Anzac Corps. And among those present were Sir James Allen and Major General Sir Andrew Russell, who was the commander of the Mounted Brigade at Gallipoli, and then briefly at the end, the New Zealand and Australian Division. And this is a photo of the bugler playing the last post on the 12th of May. You can see Sir James Allen, who was the High Commissioner in London at the time, on the left of him, Godley, and Russell on the right. And there's a number of Turks there as well. So I'll just conclude my presentation by mentioning what happened to the 4 New Zealanders. Vernon Bigweather, I already mentioned, had come back in 1920, and he farmed in North Auckland until he died in 1958. Arthur Mildenhall, on the other hand, went to France as soon as he finished at Gallipoli. The Wargraves Commission shifted him to France, and he worked there until 1932 on the cemeteries much bigger scale than at Glubley until 1932, when he retired and returned to New Zealand, and he died in 1951. Edmund Marr came back in 1925 as well, and I didn't find any information about what he did, but I presume he worked as an architect until he retired. He died in 1977. And Hurst Seeger came back as an architect in Christchurch, and then later in his life moved to Sydney, where he died in 1933. So that completes my presentation. Happy to take questions.
First comment before questions is that a lot of people think that the war was over in 1918, but a lot of our troops didn't come home, those that survived, until, you know, later in 1919, and those that were hospitalised even 1920, 21, 22, before many of them came home. But a lot of people don't appreciate the work that does go on, and that, I think this is a good account of how long it takes after a war to memorialise, to, you know, commemorate everything properly, takes quite a long time. So I think that's one of the things to come out of the presentation here, and I think that's is going to shoot the message home, I think, to a lot of people who think it's all over, done and dusted, on the 11th of November 1918. Doesn't work that way. So questions? Dennis.
What was the situation with the Turkish dead?
Turkish dead basically were left lying on the battlefield. The Turkish government didn't take the same action as the communists. No. Their attitude is somewhat different. They created cemeteries early this century. Because they were in Turkey saying, why are there no cemeteries for Turkish soldiers at Gallipoli? So the government of Turkey then created some cemeteries on the Anzac area, but they don't have any bodies with them. They're just
memorials.
They're memorials in a way. But they do have graves with peers that have got graves, but, and markers and everything, but there's no soldiers there. Bones, there's bones everywhere at Gallipoli. We found so many. We actually found two complete bodies. Storms that washed the soil away. So the protocol was to tell the War Graves Commission. They came and removed them, put them into the nearest cemetery. But even now, you would probably find graves will come to light even now. But the Turkish ones, no, they just lay where they were and moulded away.
So what's the Turkish public attitude to our memorials being there, considering they were victors and we lost them?
Well, I went there in 2004 initially, and the attitudes were very friendly and supportive and happy. And people in that area generally, they like Australians and New Zealanders in particular, and especially because our people come and spend a lot of money in that area. I noticed over the 20 years I was going there how the standard of Chinakli, especially the hotels, everything improved, because so many people were coming to stay and spending a lot of foreign currency. Attitudes are pretty good. And of course, the fictitious attitude statement about our soldiers being... there's a lot of dispute about whether that was actually said by attitude, but it's worked for 100 years as a friendship maker. No, the attitude of the Turks in the area is very supportive and as I said in this presentation, they are to be commended for what they've done. That is a wonderful area that could easily be developed into hotels. And, I mean, Trump would have a ball there if he made it the Turkish Riviera. But no, I'm in the area just north of Anzac. There are whole lots of wrecked stones lying on the ground. I said, what are those? And he said, those were houses built by people that the authorities just came and smashed down. Anyone who tries to build a house in that area, it doesn't work. They just, but who knows what the future holds. At the moment, the area is safe, even if it's not completely under the control of the commission. What it will be in the future, we don't know.
It's also interesting, I'm not sure what the education's like. When we had, if you recall, Masoud Uya, our Turkish retired colonel who gave a presentation last year, and Ian knows Masoud well, education over there is obviously very pro-Anzac, in particular pro-New Zealand. I mean, if you travel on the ferry from Egypt up to Chinaki, kids will recognise a New Zealand fern or a New Zealand flag. And so clearly there is something taught in school, primary and secondary school, about the Gallipoli campaign, and very pro-New Zealand. When you go into Istanbul Airport, just before immigration, there's the big sign on the wall showing all the countries who have to have visas, including Australia, right at the top, because it's in alphabetical order. But there's also a comment in there saying, and New Zealanders are free to enter Turkey without a visa. And that's always been the case, you know, for the last 100 years or so, or thereabouts. So there is that attitude, which is very, very pro and very supportive.
So when I was doing that, I mentioned that I was in that survey. We had a meeting with the Turks about where we were going to survey. So Turkish guy said, according to the government, the survey has to be within the boundaries of the Anzac area. Okay, that's fine, that's a map, and we can say that. So I said, it's going to be very disappointing for the New Zealand public if the survey takes place without covering Chunuk Bair, where our troops had their finest hour. And one of the Turks said, the Turkish people will be very disappointed that the New Zealand people don't recognise the Treaty of Lausanne or something. It was actually quite a diplomatic issue. The Australians had a diplomat there, but I didn't. Our government would let me take part in the survey, but it didn't fund it like the Australians. So we had a bit of a diplomatic stoush over the Anzac area, which to all intents and purposes now is not really a great moment. This was just in 2009. So they're quite sensitive about national issues, because the Treaty of Lausanne defines the boundary of modern Turkey, and they're very sensitive about anything that undermines that.
I mean, don't forget, when the war was over, you know, in 1918, you know, they did have the civil war and the war against Greece, so they really only came out of it around about 1923, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So, you know, they had another 5 or 6 years of local civil war.
A war between Greece and Turkey.
Yeah. And I mean, a lot of that contested activity is still going on today. Look at Cyprus. Mm. You know, half of it's Greek.
And it was very bloody. The city of Izmir, when Ataturk's troops arrived there, they slaughtered 200,000 Greeks who couldn't get off. There were no boats to evacuate them. The bloodshed in that war was quite extraordinary.
Other questions?
I was just wondering, when the Prime Minister met him, did he have a personal connection to Gallipoli?
He didn't. No, his son, he did have a son who served, but he served on the Western Front, and he went to serve with a British battalion on secondment and rose to major officer status, but not at Gallipoli, no, he didn't.
Yep.
Ian, I was curious about the 11 that were identified. Do you know about the history of that? 11.
Well, those are the only ones that they found bones with some identifying with the bones.
Yes.
So they could separate those and put them. I don't know what it would have been, perhaps a dog tag or something.
If they were lucky enough to find dog tags,
not sure,
the neck of a skeleton.
Yeah. There must have been something on his body that identified him, especially the boy, 17 year old.
Any other questions?
You mentioned earlier in your piece that the refusing by Malone, was that not true?
It's a myth.
I read it in a book 2 days ago from the library.
Well, unfortunately, it's very hard. 2018, I published an article in Dominion about that, which you can easily find if you Google search Malone.
I was always under the understanding that the Aucklanders had attacked first, and then Conley had been ordered to take the Wellingtons up, but he wouldn't do it in the middle of the day.
Yeah, well, that was based on the memory of a 93-year-old remembering 67 years before. And to his credit, he actually did remember an argument between Malone and a British officer, but it took place at dawn, not at 11 o'clock after the Auckland Battalion attack. When Malone came up onto Tunic Rhododendron Ridge, he deployed his battalion in defensive positions, and that's where they stayed the whole day. They were never lined up ready to attack when the Auckland Battalion failed.
No.
And even then, the Christchurch Battalion was actually in support of the Aucklanders. So, if you would have an email address, I can send you the.
I have
a very detailed.
Go onto our website.
Well, the article appeared in the Volunteers of Military History Society's journal about 2 issues ago. But I can
fascinating
send you,
because I have read several accounts that say otherwise.
Yeah, well, it's.
Can't believe it's a
historical crime being committed, because there's no evidence that Malone was ever ready to.
If you go on to our website, Ian's presentation, was it Remembrance Day last? No, the year before. Ian's presentation is on that aspect, but it also refers to the paper that Ian was mentioning. Anything else? So without further ado, thank you very much once again, and thanks, Ian.